concept of a difficult airway can be really frightening.
This is a patient safety issue.
I don't think we really need to overthink this.
I've struggled for the last 12 years to get people on board.
But this flies in the face of how we've developed our practice.
We need to be smarter.
That's a big deal.
Welcome back, everyone, to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. This is Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. And welcome to our last podcast of 2018. So hard to believe that yet another year has gone by, another year here on the podcast. And as we'll talk about as we wrap up this particular podcast or section together, we've got a few exciting new developments coming here at CCPEM. Early in 2019, we're going to be able to switch back on our CME link for those of you that have been listening and want to get CME. And also, we're continuing to further design, develop our website such that it provides you with the best experience possible for listening to podcasts. But enough about that. Let's get to our topic this month. And as we've done many years, actually every year here on CCPEM, we've ended the year or either begun the next year with just a look back of some important articles that pertain to both emergency medicine and critical care. And we're going to do that here to end 2018. We're going to look back, hit some big key articles that you really want to know moving forward into 2019. But before we get to article number one, let me say a quick hi to my amazing co-hosts here, Dr. Peter W., Dr. Gene Wood, and Dr. Rob Rodriguez. Peter, why don't you start us off? How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Doing great. Just returned from New York teaching with Symposia Medicus and an emergency medicine course, and just happy to be back home and hunker down for the holidays. Happy holidays to everybody out there.
Now, let me also ask you, we had the opportunity to do yet another exciting, fun, critical points. Any take home from critical points that we did in San Diego?
Yeah, just a phenomenal group and very intensive weekend of critical care and emergency medicine with multiple practitioners and just in an ideal setting. Just phenomenal faculty, great faculty to learner ratios, just a high time.
So definitely all of you have not attended critical points, keep on the lookout for the 2019 date. John, how are you doing?
Doing great. Have had an absolutely phenomenal 2018. I have to say, I've had a lot of interesting and wonderful experiences here in Philadelphia, both in medicine and outside of medicine with family. So it's been a great year.
Outstanding. And Rob, how about you on the West Coast?
Doing very well. Lots to be thankful for and thankful for you guys and for our listeners as well.
Couldn't agree more. Now, with that, let's jump into some important articles. Now, a whole lot has been written, a whole lot has been published over the course of 2018. And during this 30 to 40 minute podcast, we're not going to really be able to touch on every landmark article from 2018. But what we have done is pull out a few with some nice teaching points, teaching pearls that, as we'll discuss, really can begin to implement many of the take-home messages from these studies, really, with our next several shifts. So let's begin on one of the most common procedures in emergency medicine and also critical care for those that develop acute respiratory failure, and that is endotracheal intubation. Specifically, article number one deals with rapid sequence intubation. Now, if we just focus on the emergency department alone, each year in the U.S., over 300,000 intubations are performed. And overall, when you look at the success rate, specifically the first pass success rate, it hovers around 85-86%, which is good, but it still leaves us with a significant amount of improvement, that 15%. Now, in general, we have our plan A, plan B, plan C, and sometimes plan D for difficult airways. And beyond plan A, often we go to devices such as the bougie as a rescue device. Well, specifically, this first article is by Brian Driver. It was published in JAMA a few months ago. It's called the BEAM trial, titled Effective Use of a Bougie versus Endotracheal Tube and Stylet on First Attempt Intubation Success Among Patients with Difficult Airways Undergoing Emergency Intubation. This was a randomized clinical trial in JAMA. And the whole objective was to evaluate the bougie in a randomized comparison with an endotracheal tube plus stylet in emergency department patients who had at least one characteristic that was predictive of difficult laryngoscopy or a difficult intubation. So randomized trial, out of Hennepin, so a single center, where all intubations were performed by the EM faculty or EM residents. They included adult patients who were admitted to the ED who were undergoing endotracheal intubation if the attending planned to use a MAC laryngoscope blade. Overall, what they identified as characteristics of difficult airway were things that we'd all identify as difficult airway characteristics: body fluids in the laryngeal vein, airway obstruction or edema, obesity, a short neck, a small mandible, large tongue, facial trauma, as well as C-spine immobilization. Now, importantly, these characteristics were identified after the physician performed the intubation. Notwithstanding, these folks were randomized either to bougie first or the endotracheal tube with stylet. Overall, their primary outcome was what was the first attempt intubation success, and then had some secondary outcomes of hypoxemia, first attempt duration, and then the incidence of esophageal intubation. What were the results? 757 patients enrolled, but 380 had those difficult airway characteristics. And when you look at the primary outcome, first attempt success in those patients with difficult airway characteristics, going to the bougie first, 96% first attempt intubation success versus 82% where the clinician grabbed the ET tube with stylet first. In terms of secondary outcomes, if you look at all comers, so all 757, there was a higher first passed success using the bougie first, and specifically in those patients where they did an exploratory analysis, such as C-spine immobilization, as well as the obese patient, in those patients, going to bougie first resulted in a much higher first attempt success without an increase in complications, hypoxemia, or esophageal intubation. So overall, these authors suggest that in these patients with difficult airway characteristics, perhaps you should go to the bougie first instead of endotracheal tube with stylet. So let me pause there, John. Any concerns with this particular study, and how would you incorporate this into your practice?
Great question, Mike. I have to say, and I'm so glad that you led off with this article, because for me, the BEAM trial was a practice-changing article. And I'll summarize it basically. You know, I think in emergency medicine, while intubation is a skill set that we need to master and own, we still are occasional intubators, and particularly in my training residents, the concept of a difficult airway can be really frightening for a lot of residents. And so getting to a point where they get comfortable using stylet and then occasionally use a bougie as your escape plan, that's a big deal. So I've really moved to bougie with standard geometry blade as my primary intubation technique for myself, as well as when teaching residents. And I think that while the percentage differences in first pass success aren't massive, they're still fairly significantly different from a clinical perspective. And so I think that getting residents and trainees comfortable with using a bougie is absolutely imperative. And this trial did impact my clinical practice. So I've moved to using bougie with standard geometry blades on all my intubations, partly as a result of this article.
Peter, your thoughts?
So I've taught in the difficult airway course for over 10 years now, so a full decade of doing this. And I've worked with Brian and Rob Reardon from Hennepin, and I'm a huge fan of bougie, even before this paper. So this kind of validates my practice, is what it does. We know that in the UK, elective intubations in the OR, more than 90% of those are done with bougie. And the whole reason, just like it should be for us, this is a patient safety issue. It's a patient safety concern. I mean, how many times have our listeners made an attempt to intubation with stylet and ET tube and seen it go up to the cords, but didn't see it go through the cords? The assumption was that it did. And then again, if you have bougie, you can see it clearly going through the cords the majority of times when it can be obstructed by the size of the ET tube. So again, I think this is an enormous safety issue, and kudos to Brian and Rob Reardon for the jobs that they do at Hennepin.
Great points, Peter. Rob, how about your thoughts?
I don't have too much to add to what Peter and John have said before. I do use the bougie quite a bit. I don't use it in every airway. I think that there's still something to be said for traditional intubation technique in perhaps the patients that are not anticipated to have a difficult airway. I have moved towards the bougie, and I think this is very much a validating article in terms of patients who are predicted to have a difficult airway.
All right. Well, let's move on to the next article. Let's say we do successfully intubate, or actually, let's say we have had difficulty intubating a patient, despite whether we use the bougie first. Patients are becoming more hypoxemic, and then before you know it, you're in the midst of a peri-intubation cardiac arrest. Guys, have you had that scenario? So, peri-intubation cardiac arrest. Now, this brings us to the next article. This was published early in 2018 out of Critical Care Medicine. Lead author was DeJong. Title, Cardiac Arrest and Mortality Related to Intubation Procedure in Critically Ill Adult Patients, a Multi-Center Cohort Study. Overall, this particular study wanted to establish the prevalence of cardiac arrest during intubation, the mortality of those patients that did suffer a cardiac arrest, both immediately and at 28 days, and then, perhaps most importantly, to assess what were the risk factors for that peri-intubation cardiac arrest and 28-day mortality. So this was a retrospective analysis of intubations across six prospective, randomized, as well as observational studies that used a number of databases that really included a little over 60 intensive care units. These were all adult patients that got intubated, importantly, in the ICU, so not in the ED setting. And their primary outcome was intubation-related cardiac arrest that either occurred during the intubation attempt or within 5 minutes after intubation was completed, and then subsequently these patients required CPR. Overall, they included a little over 1,800 intubations, and the intubation-related cardiac arrest rate came out to be just where the literature would say it is, somewhere around 3-4%. Specifically in the study, it was 2.7%. But the reason we picked this article out is what were those factors that were associated with intubation cardiac arrest? And there were five. Arterial hypotension, so systolic pressure less than 90 prior to intubation. Hypoxemia, the absence of preoxygenation, obesity, or age over 75 years. And of all five of those, it was hypoxemia prior to intubation that was the strongest factor associated with an intubation-related cardiac arrest. No surprise, those patients who did have an intubation-related cardiac arrest had higher inpatient mortality. In fact, it was an independent risk factor for 28-day mortality. But overall, this paper highlights something that we've been talking about and reinforces something we've been talking about. Those first three of the five, hypotension, hypoxemia, and the absence of preoxygenation, are absolutely things that we can look to enhance and restore as much as we can prior to intubating patients. In other words, resuscitating before we intubate, because they are strong factors associated with intubation cardiac arrest. Peter, I'm going to start with you on this article. Any thoughts?
It seems to me that this echoes a lot of what Alan Hafner has written about before when he mentions shock index and the fact if your heart rate's higher than your systolic blood pressure, that's a great measure for who's going to get into trouble, peri-RSI. This is intuitive, and it really shifts the thought process from the traditional ABC model to making sure that instead of going straight to the airway, that we're resuscitating these patients, particularly those who are elderly, particularly those who are obese, particularly those who are already hypoxic, and those who are hypotensive. We need to do a better job of really bolstering the cardiopulmonary reserve before applying positive pressure ventilation.
Agreed. Rob, how about your thoughts?
I give limited credence to this paper, to be honest. It's a retrospective analysis of data. I certainly agree with the points that Peter made. We certainly should be trying to resuscitate the patient before intubation instead of intubating without some level of resuscitation. I certainly agree with that point. I'm not sure that this paper really proves that to me. I think that it's sort of a chicken and an egg thing. This is a retrospective analysis, and it's unclear as to whether the cardiac arrest occurred because of a lack of efforts to improve hypoxemia, or was that going to occur anyway because they were hypoxemic? So again, I agree with the points about trying to improve oxygenation pre-intubation and improving hypotension and shock before intubating a patient. I'm just not all that convinced that the odds ratios in this paper are really causal.
Great points, Rob. Always bringing home the evidence-based medicine component behind it. And John, before we leave this article, any final thoughts?
No, I think Peter and Rob hit the nail on the head. I agree with both. I think superficially, as Peter mentioned, those five factors are generally what are considered really important leading into an intubation. But also with Rob, it's hard to know, given the type of paper this is, what the RSI strategy was for each patient and whether or not even something as simple as medication dosing or intubation procedure, how it varied between patients. So definitely not something that's practice changing, but certainly reinforces some of the lessons we've learned over the past 5 to 10 years.
All right, well, let's move on to a more recent paper that was just published at the end of October and has got a lot of discussion. We haven't talked about it here on the podcast, and it deals with actually mechanical ventilation. Something that we have talked about at length is the selection of a low tidal volume for our patients. So in essence, lung protective ventilatory strategies using that tidal volume that we've repeatedly said 6 to 8 mLs per kilogram of predicted body weight. Now, we've known for a long time that this is beneficial in patients with ARDS, and we believe it's beneficial also in patients without ARDS, which brings us to this particular trial. Lead author was Simonis, titled The Effect of a Low versus Intermediate Tidal Volume Strategy on Ventilator-Free Days in Intensive Care Unit Patients Without ARDS. This was titled The PREVENT Trial, published online and at the end of October in JAMA. And overall, the objective was to test whether a ventilation strategy using low tidal volume was it superior to a ventilation strategy using intermediate tidal volumes with respect to a composite outcome of number of ventilator-free days along with days alive at day 28. This was a randomized trial carried out in 6 ICUs in the Netherlands, and they enrolled patients who were either intubated and ventilated shortly before or right after they got to the intensive care unit, and they were expected not to be extubated within 24 hours of being randomized. In addition, with respect to the randomization that occurred typically within an hour of initiation of ventilation when they got to the ICU. Now, importantly, they did not include anyone with ARDS, those less than 18, and ventilation lasting longer than 12 hours before they were admitted to the ICU and subsequently, 6 mLs per kilogram of predicted body weight, and they could either receive volume controlled or volume cycled ventilation or pressure support ventilation. With respect to that volume control or volume cycled ventilation, they started at 6, but then decreased it by 1 milliliter per kilogram of predicted body weight every hour until they got down to 4 mLs per kilogram of predicted body weight. Now, in the intermediate group, they started at 10 mLs per kilogram of predicted body weight using volume control or volume cycled ventilation. And what they did is they followed the plateau pressure, and if it was above 25, then they could dial down the tidal volume in increments of 1 mL per kilogram predicted body weight per hour, but once again, simply follow those plateau pressures. Overall, their primary outcome, the number of ventilator-free days and days alive at day 28, and the typical secondary outcomes that we've talked about for many of these studies. So ICU hospital length of stay, 28-day, 90-day mortality, ICU hospital mortality. What were complications such as ventilator-associated pneumonia, pneumothorax, atelectasis, and new ARDS? So what were the numbers? Overall, they actually screened almost 3,700 patients, but included 961. So a whole lot of patients were either excluded or missed, but that 961 did meet their number for power calculations. I think they were targeting about 951. When you look at the take-home message, the outcomes, 28 days after randomization, what was the median number of ventilator-free days for the low tidal volume group? 21. Median number of ventilator-free days in the intermediate group? 21. So no change. There was also no difference in median ICU and hospital length of stay, no difference in in-hospital or ICU mortality, same with 28 and 90-day mortality. There was not a higher incidence of ARDS, ventilator-associated pneumonia, or pneumothorax, and no difference between the groups with respect to either the need for or duration of sedatives, pain meds, or additional neuromuscular blocking agents. So, John, the authors feel that in this trial of ICU patients without ARDS, that a strategy using low tidal volumes wasn't more efficacious than using the intermediate tidal volumes with respect to ventilator-free days and, in essence, 28-day mortality. What say you about the PREVENT trial?
Oh, man. Well, this adds a little bit of a wrinkle in maybe what we've been thinking since 2000, when the ARMA trial was first published with low tidal volume ventilations and carried over to, I think, a lot of the ways in which we practice in managing patients who are at risk for ARDS. So we know there are a number of things that place a patient at risk for ARDS, and oftentimes the medical ICUs, that is something as simple as sepsis, but certainly cardiac arrest patients, which were one of the most prevalent groups in this trial, are at high risk for developing ARDS. And in general, in the United States, we've practiced to try and prevent that by using lung protective ventilation strategies. So this flies in the face of how we've developed our practice in ventilator management. Now, it certainly doesn't change my practice, but it's a singular study. And as we're taking in the body of literature, I think the body of literature still suggests to use lung protective 6 mLs per kilo, ideal body weight, for most patients. However, it'll be interesting to see over the next 5 to 10 years if some more research will then be dedicated to this important clinical question. I'm interested to hear what everyone else thinks.
Rob, what are your thoughts?
You know, my thoughts are this. There were no differences between groups, but there certainly wasn't a worsening of outcomes with lung protective ventilation, low tidal volume ventilation. So I don't think we really need to overthink this. I can't think of an argument to use higher tidal volume in any patient, really. So I don't know. I'm sticking with low tidal volume ventilation settings pretty much on all my patients. Even though there's not a documented benefit in the non-ARDS type group in this study, I think that when we start trying to overthink, well, maybe we should use low tidal volume in this patient, but not in this patient, I don't think we need to get that complicated.
What about you, Peter?
So I have strong agreement with both Rob and John on this. I would just say I've struggled for the last 12 years to get people on board with lung protective ventilation strategies using lower tidal volumes. Now, I'll be damned if one singular article that is not compelling causes me to move backward on that. Understanding that adherence to this still is between 70% and 80% in emergency departments and ICUs. So I look at this as being a little bit more dangerous of an article and not terribly helpful to me.
Because it has been so hotly discussed over the past 6 weeks since its online publication, we wanted to include it as one of those that you have to know about in 2018. So definitely pull this paper, pull the other ones that we'll talk about and have talked about thus far, and do your own deep dive analysis. Well, let's move on. And the next two articles we're really not going to touch on because we have done them at length in separate dedicated podcasts here in 2018. But these articles are definitely need-to-know important articles from 2018. And the next one deals with fluid resuscitation, and that was the SMART trial. Lead author Matt Semler, titled Balanced Crystalloids versus Saline in Critically Ill Adults, that was published early in 2018 in the New England Journal of Medicine, published along with the SALT-ED trial, specifically looking at the effect of isotonic crystalloid composition on outcomes in critically ill adults, where they compared the use of balanced crystalloids, either LR or plasmalite, with the use of saline in patients in medical and non-medical ICUs. Recall that they took a look at major adverse kidney events at 30 days, and with respect to the SMART trial, the use of balanced crystalloids rather than saline did have a favorable, albeit small, but a favorable effect on the composite outcome of death, new renal replacement therapy, or persistent renal dysfunction. So I'll direct you back to that specific fluid podcast earlier in 2018 where we did a deep dive both on the SMART and the SALT-ED trial, but it's definitely an important article you need to know from 2018. The next one also, we recently did a deeper dive, and this is cardiac arrest, specifically the utilization of epinephrine. lead author on this particular trial was Perkins, titled A Randomized Trial of Epinephrine in Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest, also published in the New England Journal of Medicine. This was the Paramedic 2 trial, another key trial that you want to know about, that was published in 2018 overall to determine whether epinephrine was beneficial or harmful as a treatment for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. And in this particular study, as we discussed during that podcast, those patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, the utilization or the use of epinephrine did result in higher rates of 30-day survival, but no difference in the rate of favorable neurologic outcome, and those that did survive and had received epinephrine more frequently had severe neurologic impairment. So guys, taking those two together, we've done an analysis of them and a discussion of them. Rob, I'll turn to you first. Any other thoughts on the SMART fluid trial or Paramedic 2 with epi and out-of-hospital cardiac arrest?
Mainly on the SMART trial, I think that we really should emphasize the need to use balanced crystalloids. I'm still finding that we're commonly overdosing patients with normal saline and winding up with this hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis that we don't need to be dealing with otherwise. So I really am pushing balanced crystalloids as a primary, just starting off with balanced crystalloids. And I don't really use saline that much anymore as my first crystalloid.
Peter, what about you?
For us at LSU in New Orleans, we really are moving more towards a ringer's initiation for all acute resuscitations. The only time we reach for the normal saline is when we have to hang blood. We're just doing that together, but otherwise it's going to be ringers.
And John?
No, I'm really hoping that the Paramedic 2 trial will really break through in the next iteration of the AHA cardiac arrest resuscitation guidelines, because I think it's a really important question and we're finally getting some more high quality data about the impact of epinephrine in cardiac arrest care.
All right, let's take the next two articles on post-arrest care kind of together and get your guys' thoughts. The first was published, actually both of them are published by Brian Roberts. The first is in Circulation and it deals with oxygen tensions immediately or in the early post-ROSC period. The first study was published in Circulation, titled Association Between Early Hyperoxia Exposure After Resuscitation from Cardiac Arrest and Neurologic Disability, a prospective, multicenter, protocol-directed cohort study. And this is something that we've talked about in prior podcasts, maybe not in 2018, but in years before, with respect to exposing patients to potentially harmful levels of oxygen. This particular study was to test the association between early post-ROSC hyperoxia and poor neurologic outcome among adult patients who were successfully resuscitated from cardiac arrest. Now, most of the other studies that have looked at hyperoxia have done so usually within the first 48 hours of ROSC, within the first 24 to 48 hours after ICU admission. This particular study, they included adult patients who presented in cardiac arrest, got ROSC for at least 20 minutes, and then what they did was obtain ABGs early, so an hour after ROSC, and then a second 6 hours after ROSC, taking a look at what those values were, with the overall primary outcome of poor neurologic function or death at hospital discharge. A number of other things with respect to secondary outcomes, but when we take a look at the results, 280 patients were included in the final cohort, and with respect to the primary outcome, in fact, hyperoxia in the early period, so ABG at 1 hour and 6 hours after ROSC, did demonstrate or was shown to be an independent predictor of poor neurologic function and hospital discharge. And for each hour of duration that patients were exposed to hyperoxia, this was associated with a 3% increase in the risk of poor neurologic outcome. Now, that's dealing with hyperoxia. Brian Roberts also published in Critical Care Medicine in 2018 something pertaining to mean arterial blood pressure in the immediate post-ROSC period. So we've talked about targeting a higher blood pressure or a higher MAP for many of these patients. This particular study was to test the association between elevated post-ROSC MAP and neurologic outcome among adult patients who were resuscitated from cardiac arrest. So it was their same center, adult patients, cardiac arrest, ROSC for greater than 20 minutes. And what they did is they measured MAP immediately after ROSC and then hourly using a non-invasive blood pressure cuff. They did not require an arterial line. Overall, their primary outcome was good neurologic function at hospital discharge. They included those same 280 subjects. With respect to the primary outcome, what they did is they grouped patients who had a MAP somewhere between 70 to 90, and then they grouped patients who had a MAP above 90 millimeters of mercury. And what they found is in those patients who had good neurologic function at hospital discharge, more of them had MAPs greater than 90 millimeters of mercury. In fact, the survival to hospital discharge was higher for those that had that higher MAP range above 90. And MAPs above 90, it was shown to be an independent predictor of good neurologic function at hospital discharge. So taking these two together, actually before I get to that point, they did demonstrate that the higher MAPs had a stronger association with improved neurologic outcome in patients with existing diagnosis of hypertension. So guys, Peter, I'm going to start with you first. Two studies in post-ROSC or post-arrest care. One demonstrating early hyperoxia is bad. And then the second demonstrating that, yes, elevated mean arterial pressures in the post-ROSC period may be associated with improved neurologic outcome. Peter, your thoughts?
Well, sure. Just the first one on hyperoxia. This is a sensitive and at-risk patient population, but I don't view it any different than the acute MI patient or the acute stroke patient. We need to be smarter with our oxygenation goals in all intubated patients, and we can look at the LOVE-ED study for that as well. I mean, shooting for numbers 94 to 98% saturations as our goals should be our standard to prevent hyperoxia and creating evil humors that kind of worsen the ischemic penumbra. The second piece, this blood pressure piece, is kind of interesting, and it's a couple of studies that have looked at this in the past 5 years that have kind of hinted at it, but they've had smaller n's. This is a larger n, a larger number, and intuitive sense. If I have chronic hypertension and I'm now hypotensive, I'm probably shooting with a goal of 65, is that my mean arterial blood pressure is a little low. The exact sweet spot for that is hard to say, and it's probably blood pressure as opposed to using a singular number. So numbers in excess of 75, 85, even 90 appear to be the way to go in those patients who are ROSC.
John, your thoughts?
No, I agree with Peter in terms of dialing down the oxygen quickly. As far as the post-arrest MAP, you know, I think AHA guidelines are recommending 65 millimeters of mercury as your minimum threshold for blood pressure. However, there is a compelling amount of evidence for targeting a MAP somewhere between 80 and 100. And this paper kind of confirms at least some of my biases and my interpretation of some of the basic literature, where a number of the studies looking at post-cardiac arrest, cerebral blood flow, autoregulation have shown that the curve shifts to the right, which essentially means that patients often require a higher pressure head in order to provide adequate cerebral blood flow in the post-cardiac arrest brain. So this is one of those epidemiologic studies that kind of points, again, to that range of probably somewhere higher than what the guidelines recommend to practice. And granted, all of this is going to be somewhat individualized, but at the end of the day, we don't have a great monitoring tool to determine what the appropriate MAP is for the brain. So I personally practice by titrating up my blood pressures as long as it's not contraindicated for whatever reason to a MAP of at least 80 in my post-cardiac arrest patients, which follows along with this paper's results.
I love both of these articles. I think they're, to me, probably the most important couple of articles of this year. What we're trying to do is we're trying to fine-tune our post-cardiac arrest resuscitation. And this gives us information about how to fine-tune our post-cardiac arrest resuscitation. Certainly, avoiding hyperoxia is absolutely clear now. I don't think there should be any question about avoidance of hyperoxia post-resuscitation. It really should be mandated and become presumably part of the AHA guidelines. But with regard to elevating the MAP post-resuscitation, I really like this as well. I'm waiting for an actual true randomized trial of elevated MAP post-resuscitation like this. This paper, of course, was a retrospective analysis in which they did not necessarily intervene in trying to elevate the MAP. So I'm anxious to see the results of a trial in which you actually start a pressor post-resuscitation and target an actual map. I am doing that as well, and I like that paper a lot.
All right. Well, my thanks to all three of you. I'm going to mention two other important articles from 2018 that we actually did two dedicated podcasts on, and that's steroids and septic shock. So recall we first started off one of our steroid discussions on the adrenal trial. Lead author Venkatesh titled Adjunctive Glucocorticoid Therapy in Patients with Septic Shock. That was New England Journal of Medicine early in 2018. And then the second was the Approaches trial. This was lead author Anane and titled Hydrocortisone plus Fludrocortisone for Adults with Septic Shock, also published a little bit later in 2018 in the New England Journal of Medicine. I'll direct you back to those two dedicated podcasts that we did on steroids and septic shock, and we'll have additional stuff in our handout for this particular episode pertaining to our important articles from 2018. Definitely important pieces of literature to familiarize yourself with their results and the utilization of steroids in the setting of septic shock. Well, that's going to do it for this particular podcast. That is going to do it for CCPEM here in 2018. And on behalf of Rob, Peter, John, and myself, we couldn't be more thankful that you tuned in all of throughout 2018 to listen to the podcast. We have such a fun time doing this with respect to education, crossing those boundaries between resuscitation, emergency medicine, and full care. And throughout the year, we've loved interacting with you, whether it be via email over the podcast discussion or whether it be at live conferences. We are so thankful and wishing you all a very happy and healthy holiday season. Peter, John, any final thoughts?
Right. Just happy holidays. And we're very thankful for the opportunity, not just to educate each other, but just to educate large groups who will touch patients and make positive impacts. So thank you guys for doing what you do out there.
Yeah, and I'll just echo that as well. You know, holidays can be oftentimes busy, but, you know, if I can leave with one pearl, take a little bit of time to spend with the ones you care about, whether it's family, friends, loved ones. You know, we talk a lot about clinical pearls in medicine, but as someone taught me not too long ago, family is just as important, particularly at this time of year, to make sure that they understand how appreciated they are.
John, and I think you're ending there with one of the most important pearls of this podcast, and that is for all of you out there, please take time this holiday season to spend with the ones that you hold most dear. Over the next few months, look for the CME link to be back up and running here on CCPEM. Our thanks to the Schumacher Group for sponsoring our CME for the podcast. And also over the coming months, please be on the lookout for a lot of enhancements to the CCPEM website. We've got a lot planned, a lot in the works, and are excited to roll that out in early 2019. And on behalf of CCPEM, Peter, Rob, John, and myself, we wish all of you a very happy new year, and we will talk to you in 2019. Bye for now.